Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
Yes, this is, I think, a kind of a global South collaboration, which is, I think, good, you know, because I don't believe that developed country could push us to be the high-income country, at least, or to be the developed country, because we have to do it by ourselves.
The Indonesian government seeks to deepen relations with Africa.
The initial comment by our president was that ECOWAS is not supportive of the coup, and the coup leaders have to ensure the safety and the reinstatement of a Nigerian president. It is this background that led to a meeting that was held on Sunday.
Nigeria's President Bola Ahmed Tinubu sent a delegation to meet the military junta in neighboring Niger.
What we are doing as the Zimbabwe Union of Journalists, obviously with regards to accreditation, is that it is a requirement at law that every journalist is accredited for them to be able to cover the elections.
And the Zimbabwe Union of Journalists is working with institutions to fact-check information during the coming elections. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Indonesia's coordinating minister for maritime affairs and investment says the administration in Jakarta seeks to deepen relations with Africa. This after Minister Luhut Binsar Panjaitan led a delegation that held meetings on trade and multilateral relations with South Africa, Kenya, and Mozambique. Following a meeting with South African President Cyril Ramaphosa, Luhut says Indonesia plans to build a power plant in South Africa to help resolve an energy crisis that has forced it to ration electricity. I reached Indonesia's coordinating minister for maritime affairs and investment, Luhut Binsar Panjaitan, via Skype. In part one of our conversation, Luhut talks about his recent trip and the experience he says his administration wants to share with African countries.
I went to Africa like 3 weeks ago. I think the third time, maybe, or fourth time. You know. So I met your President Cyril. And I understand that you South Africa sorted like 5 gigawatts of electricity. So I brought with me CEO Pertamina at the time, Indonesian state oil company. So we look at the possibility that we can build a power plant, energy by gas from Mozambique. So we offer this to President Cyril, and President Cyril responds very positively, and because I said within 3 to 4 years we can build this power plant, so we can solve your problem on the shortage of electricity. And besides that, I think we could establish a close collaboration with South Africa. It's like, you know, because you produce a lot of soybean, so we're going to import 300,000 tons of soybean from South Africa, and another 20,000 kettles. I think this is 50,000 kettles per year, but this one we begin with the 20,000 kettles per year. So that's, I think, the one issue that we discussed. And the other issue also we discussed about, you know, the raw material. So what we're doing in Indonesia, downstreaming industry on our own critical mineral like nickel ore and tin, copper, bauxite, and like also palm oil and seaweed and gas also. Why we export the raw material if you can, you know, process domestically first, so then we can see the added value for the interest of our people. So one item like nickel ore, we are the largest nickel ore reserve in the world. And after 7 years, I think give impact like 6 times than our revenue before. You know, so this is, I think, give some very good, confidence toward the people of Indonesia. So I share this experience to President Cyril. I said, if Indonesia can do it, I think South Africa can do it also. The same thing, meeting also with President Felix and President Ruto later on in Kinshasa and Nairobi. So I think this is part of the, the continuation of the spirit, Bandung spirit, the Asia-Africa conference back to 1955.
So interesting. So basically, Indonesia want to deepen trade on and bilateral relations with countries in Africa, sub-Saharan Africa specifically, right? Talk to me about other collaborations with the effort to deepen those trade and bilateral relations.
Yes, this is, I think, a kind of a global south, global south collaboration, which is, I think, good, because I don't believe that developed country could push us to be the high-income country at least, or to be developed country, because we have to do it by ourselves. And then they can help us. Don't expect that some other countries can help you, can support you without your own effort also. So that's what I believe. So I discuss this or share our experience with President Cyril, President Felix, and President Ruto about this. And those three presidents, I think they are really extremely good president, as far as I understand. And see what happened. The President Joko Widodo will visit South Africa on the 22nd, 21st maybe, and then 21st to Kenya, and then to South Africa, and South Africa to Mozambique, Tanzania, and the 25th in Kinshasa. And we are looking for also other collaboration on tropical forestry. Tropical forestry, Indonesia, DRC, Congo, and also Brazil. And if you put this those country and also the other like 12 countries from Africa and maybe the other 6-8 countries from Brazil, I think tropical forestry already like over 70% within in this this developing country. So this is, I think, good to show to the world that the developing countries also could contribute a lot on the climate change issue here.
So, Minister Luhut, what informed the decision for Indonesia or the government in Jakarta to want to deepen trade relations and other multi and bilateral relations with the countries on the African continent?
Well, I think we share our same experience. If you look at back to 1955, so I think it's, if we can share what we experienced, the good and the bad thing, and learn a lesson that we experienced, why not to our brother in Africa, for instance, because we feel Africa, Indonesia, with the spirit of Asia-Africa in Bandung Conference, still there, So at the time, we are talking about decolonization. Right now, we are talking about prosperity and equality. So that's, I think, the different theme of this time. Yeah.
Luhut Binsar Panjaitan is Indonesia's coordinating minister of investment and maritime affairs. He spoke with me via Skype from here in Washington. Join us on Sunday for the conclusion of the conversation. Nigeria's President Bola Ahmed Tinubu sent a delegation to meet the military junta in neighboring Niger. The delegation was led by former Nigerian military ruler General Abdul Salami Abubakar. Officials say the president also sent delegations to other neighboring countries in an effort to help resolve the political crisis in Niger. The move comes as a one-week ultimatum issued by the Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS, expires. The regional organization, which has a zero-tolerance policy for the forceful overthrow of a legitimately elected government, has imposed sanctions against Niger. Thus, following the overthrow of President Mohamed Bazoum's administration, it is demanding Bazoum's reinstatement after refusing to accept the coup. For analysis of the situation and the prospects of the delegation to resolve the crisis in Niger, I reach Ibrahim Momo. He is a political analyst based in the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
The initial comment by our president was that ECOWAS is not supportive of the coup, and the coup leaders have to ensure the safety and the reinstatement of a Nigerian president. It is this background that led to a meeting that was held on Sunday. And then after that, you know, ECOWAS came out with a communique requesting the immediate reinstatement, you know, of the president of Niger within 7 days. Within 7 days. You know, Niger is a landlocked country. So, indeed, in terms of trade and in terms of its interaction with the international community, it tends to relate particularly with Nigeria, you know. So that's the issue. And then one of the immediate sanctions that Nigeria has imposed is that Niger gets its power supply from Nigeria. That has now been cut off.
But if Nigeria on its own, based on a decision taken by ECOWAS, it has cut off power that Niger gets from Nigeria, and such that there's a rolling blackout in Niger, how effective will this emissary sent by President Tinubu make any inroads in the attempt to find out what is going on and how to resolve the crisis?
You see, Nigeria is like the big brother of in the West African sub-region. In fact, Nigeria's economy, it's about 60% of the entire West African GDP. You know, so a country like Niger, whose border is a total of 1,608 kilometers long. So when Nigeria is taking out sanctions, it's definitely going to hurt the Nigerian economy seriously. And then if you add that to the fact that the French and the U.S. Administrations who have a military presence even in Niger are also against the recent coup d'etat. You can see that Niger is in a whole lot of pressure, a kind of serious pressure. So, and then you now add that to the sanction being imposed. Not only the sanctions also include closure of border. Niger's economy is largely dependent on Nigeria as a survivor. So when Nigeria has now closed her border with Niger, you expect that when it comes to commerce, power, instead of trade, Niger mostly trades with Nigeria. When it comes to power supply, Nigeria supplies Niger the power that it uses, which is now leading to blackouts all over Niger Republic. And there's no immediate replacement.
Do you see any military action led by Nigeria against Niger to return President Bazoum to the helm of affairs in Niger?
Well, why we can't rule it out is because the ECOWAS heads of government, heads of states, have meeting, resolved that it is a possibility that if a constitutional order is not restored. So what I foresee one, I think except ECOWAS does not want to be taken for granted. It will eventually have to decide on military action. But the strategy is not, that it should not be the first line of action. Because if you imagine that in Sudan, in Chad, in Mali, in Burkina Faso, and in Guinea, all countries bordering Niger or close to Niger are all ruled by military putschists. So if you consider that the Nigerian junta have support from these countries already. But is the support enough to overlook the sanctions of Nigeria? I think it is not. And then if care is not taken, it's clear that ultimately, very soon, if all the effort and aggression fail, the likelihood of a military takeover, because it is even in Nigeria's corporate interest not to allow a coup in Niger, because there is a bandwagon effect.
Ibrahim Momo is a political analyst in Nigeria. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Still in Nigeria, a civil society group is calling on the Senate not to approve public officials who are accused of corruption. The Civil Society Legislative Advisory Center, or CISLAC, says it appears a number of officials being vetted by the Senate have allegations of corruption against them by the country's anti-graft agencies. They are calling on them to step aside until they are officially cleared. This as the Senate continues vetting nominations from President Bola Tinubu. The president submitted the names to be approved to serve as ministers in his government. Critics say some of the names have allegations to answer for, but supporters of the ruling party argue that they are all innocent until proven guilty. They are urging the Senate to approve the list of ministers to help resolve the challenges Nigerians are facing. Awal Musa is the executive director of the Civil Society Legislative Advisory Center, or CISLAC. He tells me that the president must not be seen as employing people who have been accused of graft and fraud.
We are very, very worried and concerned that President Tinubu appears to be recycling people with huge corruption allegations. As ministers, as even some of the principal officers in the National Assembly, including the sitting Senate president who has been, you know, having serious corruption cases with the EFCC, you know, Tinubu insisted and used his executive power to ensure that Senator Akpabio is given the leadership of the Senate, you know, presidency in National Assembly. This is very sad development, and people who have looted this country and who have aided the looters are now being considered for several, you know, positions. This is really not good for Nigeria, especially as we have suffered in the hands of corrupt public officials and now recycling them to further entrench poverty, unemployment and discomfort in the country.
If the calls are not adhered to, does that mean that the fight against corruption will be significantly weakened, as these civil society groups, including yours, are saying?
It has already been weakened. When you have, you know, the number three with the serious corruption allegation and investigation going on him, and you know, suddenly he, you know, they made him to be the Senate president. You have already, you know, weaken the institution from Pala doing anything. They can't invite him. They can't investigate him. And likewise, to some of the governors who have looted their states, who are under investigation, they cannot continue with their cases because they have, you know, support and protection of the Mr. President. And this is really dangerous, you know, for our, you know, strengthening of the institution and anti-corruption in Nigeria. This administration appears to be an administration for settlement and for regrouping people who have helped to loot the country or to, you know, perpetrate corruption or wrongdoing in the country, like many Nigerians are alleged to.
Some people are suggesting that if those people who the president has selected to serve with him in government, who have allegations of corruption against them, are not approved, that means there are a lot of people in Nigeria who might not necessarily pass that litmus test due to the EFCC's work on trying to weed out corruption. Political players in Nigeria have debt on their hands, so the president might find it tough to assemble his cabinet. What are your thoughts?
That's not correct. There are quite a number of nominations he had made that Nigerians, they did not see them as corrupt and that they have no any corruption cases. You know, so it is, if the president wanted, he could as well, you know, go and find Nigerians that are competent, that are qualified, that are not having corruption burden, or that are not even associated with any looting in the country. You can find them from all the states across the country.
Where do Nigerians go from here, looking at the number of people that allegations of corruption have been made against them?
Already some of them have already, you know, been appointed and they have already resumed work. And some of the ministers that have also been cleared, you know, by the National Assembly, they will definitely, you know, he will definitely go with them, because he is one person that if he insists to do something, he will definitely do that. So the only option for Nigerians is to continue to, you know, express their worry and concern and demand that corruption and corrupt people must not take over the country, because this means that corruption and corrupt people have been democratized in the country. So there's a popular participation in democracy, I mean, in the looters and, you know, corrupt people in this government. Before, there appears to be like a pretense, but now it is very open, and they will continue to do that, and they will expand their looting if civil society, media, Nigerian people did not rise up to challenge this impunity and this destruction of the country by assembling crooks and criminals and, you know, corrupt people to take over governance in this country. And that is why many Nigerians will not see development, will not see improvement in healthcare, in education, in infrastructure, in power and energy, because corrupt people, people who are used to corruption, who are used to siphoning public taxpayers' money, are now populating the governance structure in the country. And that's really sad.
Awal Musa is the executive director of the Civil Society Legislative Advisory Center, or CISLAC. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. In Sierra Leone, the main opposition All People's Congress, or APC, says it stands by its decision to boycott the legislature. The party has demanded its members of parliament not to attend sessions in protest against the outcome of the recent general election. Citing irregularities and rigging, the APC demands that the Electoral Commission of Sierra Leone release all results to ensure transparency. This after accusing the electoral body of a lack of transparency in administering the recent polls, an accusation officials of the Electoral Commission deny. Abdoulaye Kagbo is an APC member of parliament. He tells me that the failure of the Electoral Commission to release all results from polling stations across the country will significantly damage confidence citizens have in the polls.
Yes, of course, our position statement was very clear. No sooner the results were announced, because our party agents and counting agents did not know what was collated. What was collated at the tally center was never made available to them. They did not see the figures. They did not know how these figures were reached at. Even though we have our IRF and the party has collated its own figures, which are quite different from that which was announced by ECSN. The party gave an ultimatum to ECSN. The first ultimatum is to make sure that they publish the disaggregated data so we can be able to make comparative analysis between what is published, and what we have in our own palace center, so that we can be able to ascertain whether these results are okay, whether these results are in accordance with the IRF that we have distributed in the various polling stations. And up to now, ECSL has not done that.
Now, let me ask you this. Since the APC boycotted or made a firm decision to boycott the governance of the country, what so far do you think has been the reaction of the people of Sierra Leone? Because the country is moving forward. The president has been sworn in. He's assembled his cabinet. Some people are actually saying that the APC parliamentarians are not representing their constituencies when they were voted for.
Of course, we did not just take these actions without consulting our people. In fact, the pressure we had is from our people that we shouldn't in any way enter or accept this result until the disaggregated data are displayed. You know, one thing we want to make very clear is that Sierra Leone is a democratic country. If we give ECSL the right to announce whichever results they want to announce, and nobody will hold them accountable, then let us forget about democracy. Let us forget about elections. Let us forget about campaigning. Because even when we have campaigned, even when they have registered, even when they vote, at the end of the day, it is what they announce that will be valid, not what the people voted, you see. So we want to let the democratic space be very straightened. Let people have the full confidence in going into elections.
For the last few weeks that the APC has embarked on its decision to boycott governance, what has been the feedback so far from your constituencies or your supporters across the country?
Our supporters are very pleased. They are very pleased. Our supporters are afraid that if we give accreditations to these results that are announced, then they'll be skeptical whether they'll vote again in any elections, because their vote will not be counted their vote will not matter. And it is what ECSL feels like announcing is what they will announce. So they are pleased that we are holding ECSL to account, and they are pleased that we are requesting for disaggregated data from ECSL so that the queue that they made during elections, you know, will be accounted for. Their votes will be accounted for.
After the six-month ultimatum elapses, what happens?
Well, basically, we have a structured political party. We are where we are because of the decision of the party. The party has its organ. We have the National Delegate Conference, which is the topmost organ, and we have the National Advisory Committee, NAC, which is the second topmost organ. So basically, they will sit and decide on the way forward.
The Speaker of the Parliament, Dr. Abas Bundu, is quoted as saying that if the APC members of Parliament who were voted for do not take or attend parliamentary sitting, he might be forced to declare the seats vacant. Are you prepared for that?
You see, it also amazes me when people of authority, people in high places, are not even concerned about electioneering transparency. They are not even concerned about the electoral processes, you know, because they should be concerned. APC has not asked for anything different. APC has not asked for anything difficult. For them to have been able to successfully collate the district results, it means they collated it from the source document, which is the polling stations results. So if Speaker is not concerned about what ECSL collated and what we had in the polling stations, it means that in whatsoever any other ECSL team would announce, everybody should comply by it, whether it reflects the true voice of the people or it does not reflect the true voice of the people. And that is a concern for our democratic space in Sierra Leone.
Abdoulaye Kagbo is an APC member of parliament. He spoke with me from the Sierra Leonean capital, Freetown. The Zimbabwe Union of Journalists says it is working with other groups to fact-check information during the coming elections. This, it says, forms part of the effort to combat misinformation in the run-up to the August 23 general election. Zimbabweans go to the polls to choose a new president and lawmakers. Some citizens express concern about fake news some political players are using on social media platforms such as Facebook and WhatsApp to confuse voters. Perfect Nswati Longwani is the Secretary General of the Zimbabwe Union of Journalists. He tells me that it is important for voters to have the right information they need to make informed decisions during the vote.
What we are doing as the Zimbabwe Union of Journalists, obviously with regards to accreditation, is that it is a requirement at law that every journalist is accredited for them to be able to cover the elections. And normally it is the various media houses that then facilitate that journalists are accredited, because there is some money that is needed to be paid for journalists to be accredited, both by the Zimbabwe Media Commission and by the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission. Probably you would have seen that it is one of the things that we have been engaging the commission, the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission, on, to say that there is no need for journalists to pay when they are then accredited by the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission, because we think that the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission is given a budget to run the elections and must use that budget to run the elections without asking journalists to pay and do their work without any challenge.
Some people have suggested that perhaps it is a way to try to weed out those who they deem are critical of. Is this the case?
Not necessarily, not necessarily. Remember I said that media houses, different media houses in the country are the ones that facilitate for their journalists, their reporters, to be able to go and get accredited. So it does not matter whether they are critical of the government or not. But when they go there, they get accredited. I think what has been the challenge is the cumbersome system and the process that the journalists are then going through to be able to get accredited by the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission. But it's not an issue that it is closing out anyone, because everyone is allowed to be accredited by the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission.
How is Suj helping with the issues of fake news or peddling of information that is not accurate?
Wonderful. So we are carrying out quite a number of trainings for our journalists, our members, to capacitate them to ensure that they continue to stick to the basics of journalism, which is to make sure that whenever and wherever they are reporting, their stories are factual, their stories are balanced, and their stories are fair. They represent both sides to the story. As they say, each story has two sides, or even the multiple angles that the story would have. So we are carrying out trainings with our journalists to ensure that they know. But above that, we are also working together with institutions that specialize in fact-checking. And we have been encouraging media houses themselves to say they must have systems within those media houses that will help them with fact-checking and ensuring that there is no misinformation and disinformation, as it were.
How is the cooperation between the Suj and other media organizations in this work to provide the enabling environment for journalists to operate freely?
We have quite a cordial working relation between ourselves and other stakeholders, other organizations that represent the media, the Media Institute of Southern Africa, the Voluntary Media Council of Zimbabwe. We have even gone a step further to engage stakeholders such as the police, such as government itself, the Ministry of Information. We have gone a step further to engage political parties with regards to issues of safety and security of our journalists. And we are happy that at least in principle we are agreed that we must ensure that journalists work without any challenge, harassment, any encumbrance. Yeah, we have engaged the police. We have engaged the police command element across the country, where we were discussing issues of security and safety of our journalists. And they have committed to say that as we are heading towards this election, they are going to ensure that our journalists are protected and they are safe.
Perfect. Nswati Longwane is the Secretary General of the Zimbabwe Union of Journalists. He spoke with me from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare. In Tunisia, President Kais Saied has appointed Ahmed Hachani as the new prime minister. He replaces Najla Boudin. This after Tunisians complain of tough economic conditions. The president blames government officials for not coming up with solutions to such challenges as water and electricity cuts, as well as poor public services. But critics say the president has failed to take responsibility for the failures. They also accuse him of dictatorship, accusations his supporters reject. For the latest development and analysis, I reach Mohamed Dia Hamami. He is a non-resident fellow at the think tank Dawn, that is Democracy in the Arab World Now, and a political science doctorate student at Syracuse University in New York.
First of all, the decision to remove now former Prime Minister Boudin was not surprising, because there was a divergence of views between her government and the president that became increasingly visible over the last few months. And even among Saied's supporters and closest allies, there were calls for her dismissal and the replacement of her government as a strategy of scapegoating to reduce the blame on Saied and put the responsibility of the failed economic policies of the last 2 years on her and not on Saied. And this might even have to do with the preparation of the upcoming 2024 elections.
But some people are suggesting that it appears For somebody who is a lawyer, an elite, so to speak, with the technical know-how, he appears not to be able to effectively administer the affairs of the Tunisian government that he heads. Do you think this criticism is justified?
Yes, absolutely. And I think because Saïd is much more concerned about the liability and the amount of threat that a prime minister would represent than the level of competence. So that's why he's been mostly relying on his interpersonal connections for recruitment. So the new prime minister was attending the same school as Saïd in the 1970s. They graduated almost at the same time. He also was the classmate of the former prime minister in high school. So they belong to the same close, interconnected social environment. And that's the primary factor that Saïd seemed to be taking into consideration. He's not willing to take the risk of appointing someone who is more competent than him, but may potentially overthrow him or appear are more legitimate or more performant than him in the next elections, for example.
Well, President Saïd Kaïd had repeatedly blamed officials and government, saying they must act to address problems and poor public services, including frequent water and electricity cuts. But he is the one who put these people in position. So why is he not taking the blame? Why is the buck not stopping with him?
Well, Saïd has been blaming others for everything. That was his strategy since the very beginning. When the COVID situation was bad, he blamed the parliament and decided to overthrow the entire political system. And he's been doing that persistently. But what's more concerning about these accusations that have to do with access of water is that instead of taking seriously the problem of water shortages in Tunisia and seeing them as systemic, he's seeing them as a conspiracy against him and his rule. And so he ends up blaming bureaucrats who are trying their best to do their job, but simply because we don't have enough water and the resources of water are being depleted, they cannot respond to the demand. So I'm more concerned of Saïd's inability to understand structural problems than his scapegoating strategy targeting bureaucrats and public officials.
Some of his critics are suggesting that for the actions that he's taken, including dissolving parliament, making sure he consolidated more power in his hands, blaming everybody else apart from himself, with some of the things not going right in his administration, they are accusing him of being more dictatorial as the years go by. How are Tunisians reacting to this criticism from some of his opponents?
So the public opinion in Tunisia is really unstable. When the coup happened initially, people had a high level of optimism. They thought that he's going to change things and get things done. But it quickly decreased. And when we saw the only 11% of the population showing up in the elections that followed the adoption of a new constitution that concentrates power at the level of the presidency, there were only 11%. So we were quite surprised to see that the level of active popularity is very low. But the problem is that we don't have so far someone who is... who can represent a serious threat to Saïd in the 2024 elections.
Mohamed Diam Hamami is a non-resident fellow at the think tank Dawn, Democracy in the Arab World Now, and a political science doctorate student at Syracuse University in New York. He spoke with me from New York. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, or DRC, the opposition party Ensemble says the murder of its spokesman and the arrest of a close advisor to its presidential candidate appears to be a calculated attempt to harass and intimidate its members. This after the killing of Cherubin Okende by unknown people and the arrest of Solomon Kalondi, a close advisor to Moise Katumbi. The party also expressed concern that the Electoral Commission has so far refused to allow an independent audit of the voter list that will be used for the December elections. Several opposition parties have backed the call for an independent audit. Some have even threatened to boycott the polls if the electoral body continues to resist calls for the procedure. But the chairman of the poll organization says the voter list has already been vetted and is now ready to be used. Olivier Kambitatu is a spokesperson for the DRC opposition party Ensemble. He tells me that his party will compete and defeat incumbent President Félix Tshisekedi in spite of what he says are obvious disadvantages facing the group.
The assassination of Chérubin Okendi, the spokesman of Moïse Katumbi's political party Ensemble, and the arrest of Solomon Kalonda, Katumbi's advisors, at the Kinshasa airport came as a shock for the opposition. And you know that the military intelligence in DRC accused Kalonda of spying on behalf of Rwanda and of the M23 Congolese Tutsi rebels. But it's considered as a pretext by all our political party. The assassination of Chérubin Okendi, member of the parliament, the Honorable Chérubin Okendi, it's obviously the evidence that the responsible for that assassination is to find not in the opposition, but it's major. The responsibility of the power.
But supporters of the government are saying that investigations are going on to determine who killed the spokesperson of Ensemble, and that blaming the government is unfortunate, and that there's evidence against the intelligence officer who they said they have evidence against him spying for Rwanda and, for that matter, the M23 rebel group. Aren't you concerned?
No, it's a totally fake issue, and they have no one single evidence. They want to build something out of nowhere. So we consider that the power fear the candidacy of Moïse Katumbi. That's the reason why they want to implicate Moïse Katumbi in such bad things. It's totally fake.
Why do you think the authorities are afraid of Moïse Katumbi candidacy? They won the election the last time, and they are promising to win the election again with the majority of the people on their side. So why should they be afraid of Moïse Katumbi's candidacy?
Because everybody knows that 5 years ago it was rigged and fake elections. And President Tshisekedi came to power after negotiation with his predecessor, Joseph Kabila. And today everybody knows that Moïse Katumbi, the former governor of Katanga, is very popular. That's the reason why they fear the candidacy of Moïse Katumbi. Now we want to go to elections, but we want the credibility of these elections. It's very important for us.
A lot of the political parties are calling for an independent audit of the voter list. But the chairman of the Electoral Commission is saying that that audit has already been done.
You know, Mr. Kadima, the chairman of the Bureau of the Electoral Commission, is joking. He knows perfectly well that it was not an independent audit. He chose himself some good friends of him to organize this audit. We want an independent organization to audit this the voter register, yeah. And now it's very important for us. But in the same time, we don't want to be out of this process because we know that the people of Congo is very mature and they will vote for another leader.
Some opposition groups are saying if the audit is not done, they will not participate in the election, which basically will give President Tshisekedi another mandate. What is your party's position on this?
Our political party, Ensemble, we will be part of the electoral process because we want to demonstrate that the huge majority of the Congolese people, they want a real change in Congo. So we don't want to give another mandate to Felix Tshisekedi. That's the reason why we will go to elections.
So how credible do you think this election will be?
With the support of the international community, with international observers, with the support of the church, the Catholic Church, and the Protestant Church, we will do our best to get good elections with international observers in Congo.
Olivier Kamitatu is a spokesperson for the DRC Opposition Party Ensemble. He spoke with me from Brussels, Belgium. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. It's now time for music from our African collection. That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Douglas Impuga, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, there are no shortcuts to the top of a palm tree. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.